an unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Well, good evening. We're getting close to the end of this book. So I hope there will be some thought about where to go next. We're not there yet, but it's coming up. This part, I didn't get all the way through the chapter of manifesting creativity last week. That's one of my favorite subjects, just because I've always been making things. I think most of us have been making things most of our life. Sometimes they're to be seen, and sometimes not. But there is nothing, no greater joy that I know of than making something that comes up in your own mind. It's an activity that is in which you feel the joy of disappearing in a way. It's so intense sometimes. You just have an idea and you have to do it. I'm reading a wonderful book. Maybe some of you have it too. It's a huge book about Leonardo da Vinci that just came out. It's this thick. One of my sons sent it to me, and it's wonderful. And it talks about his process, which is he just gets struck by an idea and he follows it all the way to the end. How is the body put together? How are horses put together first? And he gets real interested in the muscles and the eyes and all, and starts drawing it and studying it, and actually did dissections to see how the muscles were connected. And then he thought, well, if it's horses like that, how about humans? So he got in touch with the hospital and started getting cadavers and taking those apart and seeing how they were put together. And he said artists didn't understand this at all, and that depending on the position of an arm, things would be taken small or large depending on the position that the body takes, and that the body is always expressing some kind of emotion. And it was never considered about that before, but this emotion is actually showing through us constantly. We're shining with it. It's very interesting. And he was continually creative his whole life. He was interested in numbers, in inventing things, like he wanted to learn how to fly. So he studied birds and created flying machines. He wanted to create a perpetual motion machine, and went all the way through the thinking that goes into that, and realized that, nope, you can't do it. It's not possible. But it took him months and months to figure it all out, because there's so many ways you can think about it. But in the end, nope, you can't do it. So he spent a whole life with his notebooks, putting all of his beautiful sketches and his ideas, and every now and then getting a commission from some important person to do a painting. And mostly he did the paintings, although kind of quarreling with some of them because they wanted one way and he wanted it another. But otherwise, all his brilliant ideas stayed in the notebooks for hundreds of years. He was way ahead of his time. They had to reinvent most of the things that he invented back then in the 1400s. It's just amazing. He was an exception because he was kind of obsessed all the time. He was a show-off. He just loved to dress up in fancy clothes, and he loved to put on festivals and make things fly in the air to wow people. And he could do a lot of great stuff like that and tell jokes and have parties. But most of the time, he was creating on a very much deeper level, trying to understand the human being, what it is to be. And I think all of us are doing that in our creativity in one way or another. We're always probing this life, trying to understand it, trying to... Once we get involved in a process of some kind, whether we're teaching or painting or chopping wood, we're so involved. In fact, he says we're so involved that that it's Buddha being alive. It's the life of Buddha itself. We think Buddha as some, I don't know what we think Buddha is. Buddha is a funny word. It just means awake. It doesn't mean anything else. It just means awake. Once it becomes a word that is hard to understand, then we begin to project on it all kinds of weirdnesses. It becomes kind of alien and strange and wonderful and mysterious. But if you think of it as awake, which is the true meaning of it, then it suddenly becomes something that we ourselves can understand in our own life. It's not out there anywhere. It isn't way back then either. Buddha was a man who woke up. And our effort, our creative effort, is constantly trying to wake up. He says, Buddha is something alive, constantly moving. Digest sitting Buddha, and it becomes energy for your life. So then he goes into Zazen, which is the ultimate awake position, you could say. The place where we become very aware of our energy, our vitality, our being itself. We're not skiing, we're not climbing a mountain, we're just sitting quietly. And at first, of course, we're full of conversation because we have so many words that go on and so many justifications that we have to create for ourselves and all of those things that go on in our mind. But after a while, that gets boring. And the more we sit, the more we can bring ourselves back to the present, to just the sound of the air and what goes on around, and the feeling of being a body. And of course, the body begins to ache. Something is always hurting. Always. There's no time when something isn't hurting. And it's usually we try to distract ourselves and take ourselves in some sort of fancy place where we're not there. But if we keep coming back, we begin to appreciate what the body endures, what the body does. It's really a very, very noble creature. And the more we pay attention to it, the more awake we are to it, the more grateful we become. And the more we sit often, in spite of the pain and suffering that we go through with sitting, because there is something else going on in sitting. Something else shows up when we sit. If we try to name it and talk about it, we kind of spoil it. Even though we have to talk about it, because it helps to acknowledge that there is something happening. He says, if you manifest creativity in your life, you are manifesting your complete life form and not form, coming together and working together. This is your time and opportunity. When time and opportunity are working within your activity, form and not form are dissipated and melted right in the middle of total activity. You don't know what time it is, and you don't care anymore. Time just flies, as we say. It flies. Oh, what time is it? I have no idea. So every day, every moment, try to think, where is the possibility of approaching to this very moment? I'm not sure we would think in quite those terms. It's kind of how can I be here? How can I just be right here? Here at the kitchen sink, here behind the wheel of the car, here face to face with somebody I don't like, here with my dog. Every situation we're in is a here with something. It's all relational. And the more aware we are of that, the more amazing and alive life feels and becomes. You must be fresh every single moment. Suffering comes. In the next moment, you must be fresh. And then suffering dissipates in the Dharma world. But then in the next moment, new suffering comes. So you just have to walk step by step. If you do this, very naturally you become humble and majestic. Super, huh? Mm-hmm. Humble and majestic, I love that. It's important to remember our dignity. We all have great dignity, and we forget it so easily. Oh, it's just me, sloppy old me. But inside of each one of us is a great majesty and dignity. In a completely ordinary life, in a no big deal life, in a not famous, not beautiful, not wonderful life, is dignity and majesty in each one of us. When you really approach this very moment, you show deep kindness. That's called compassion, he says. But if I say be kind, you immediately imagine the usual sense of kindness and jump into it. Oh yes, I'm going to be good to everybody. Huh? Not going to happen. But if you're present, if you're really present so that you know what's happening, if you're aware and clear of what's going on, it's a lot easier to be kind because you're a part of what's going on, not distant from it, not separate. And it's the separation that makes our life so miserable. Compassion is not something you try to have. Compassion is when you, your body, your time, and your place all work together. When you manifest creativity in your life, you feel a very deep compassion for your book, your feet, your clothes, and your thoughts. This is called intimacy. You can touch what real kindness is by the way you get dressed in the morning, eat a meal, or sit zazen. You just settle down right now, right here, and then compassion comes up. He said his teachers told him he should take best care of Dharma. And he puzzled over what Dharma was for years and years and finally realized it just meant the truth. Just stick with the truth, not the story, but what's behind the story, what's inside the story. It's not a philosophical idea, he says. We have to find the truth, find Dharma practically. Where do we find it? Right here, right now, in the moment. When time, place, and person are dissipated within this very moment, it's called Dharma. And we're just here doing our thing, whatever the thing is. So in terms of zazen, it's a form. It's a form and it's not a form. And of course, as Americans, and Americans who've been through the 60s and 70s, especially I think most of us, the rigors of form sometimes are something that we object to because there's this sense of finally finding independence, freedom from having to conform. And zazen is a very conforming kind of activity. So it brings us to a place of having to agree to do this thing, and in a particular way. So it takes, again, some real thought about how to do this and be with it as a body, as a mind and body. Dogen Zenji says we have to abandon our usual understanding of the zazen posture and touch the heart of zazen, which is to know this. First, you have to throw away the usual sense of form. If you touch the heart of the zazen posture, the usual form of zazen is dissipated very naturally. So it can be an imposition on us that we have to do it a certain way, or it can be one of our creative exercises. It can be the thing that we do as, that we love the most and in which we most disappear because it's completely absorbing, I would say, instead of dissipating. It's very, very absorbing. It absorbs everything. It becomes everything. It's a concentration of all concentrations, you could say, but it's not even a concentration, it's just being there. He talks about climbing a mountain and how difficult it is and how much you have to prepare for it and all the stuff you have to carry with you, and it's very, very inconvenient and it's really, really hard. But you love to climb the mountain, so you're willing to put up with all that stuff. And he says zazen is the same, or whatever we do really, that if it's there's something in there for us, we do it anyway. He says the zazen posture is really painful, creating lots of stiffness, just like climbing a mountain. But you love something that is in the heart of your life. Climbing a mountain is called life, and you have to carry a form in order to do that. And it's a bother, but you do it anyway. So at the heart of Zazen, there's nothing to see and nothing to touch. No principles of practice, no training, no discipline, no truth. There's only the form itself. You can add all those things onto it. You can add all kinds of fancy little tricks to Zazen. But Zazen is really just very plain and simple. And then he warns about being attached to the form of Zazen, because some people get carried away and just sit. In the early years with Koban, there were a number of very young people who just got besotted, fell in love really with Zazen, and just thought they would sit forever, and left home and left school and left jobs and just walked around in rags practically and devoted themselves to sitting. Steve Jobs was one of those. And got nowhere, actually, for a long, long time, until they began to see what they were doing. They weren't climbing a mountain. They were just lost with an attachment. He says an interesting thing. He says moment is the time and opportunity for you to mature. That we get ripe in the moment itself. That our whole being ripens as we live. The more authentically and more presently we live, the more mature we become, the sweeter we become, the riper. He says, a diver jumping off the cliff, a mountain climber, an artist, a poet, or a musician creates a beautiful form that manifests the maturity of his or her life. But spiritual life doesn't have that same sense of performance. So creativity and religion cannot manifest in the same way. Of course, you do manifest maturity, because as Dogen says, you cannot avoid detachment from the Zazen posture. You can't get out of it, even if you have to sit in a chair. Moment after moment, you must be free from the beautiful form you created, because the moment in which that form existed is already gone. So sitting, sometimes we have a beautiful moment, and then we want to keep it. And then our Zazen becomes a very grabby kind of thing. Oh, where is it? Where if I, you know, shift, change. And sitting just disappears. Just being in the next moment that comes up. Just be willing to let everything go as it wants to go. So what is this Zazen practice that we do? It's not doing Zazen. If you believe it's doing Zazen, then practice is just a job. And that's a big burden for you. That's not a true understanding of practice. Buddhist practice is to constantly create beauty. Beauty is the functioning of wisdom. This is something that Buddha said. That's why Dogen Zenji says that you have to abandon the usual understanding of the form of Zazen and touch its heart. Otherwise, you can't maintain this kind of practice. That's why I have to explain it and why you have to understand very deeply what practice means. Then, if you understand even slightly, you should keep going. That makes your life mature. And that's how he ends the chapter. So there's a little time for questions, discussion. Yup.
Thanks. I was wondering, from your perspective, how has your understanding of sitting as a practice evolved over your life?
In one way, it hasn't evolved at all. Every time I sit down, I feel like I'm starting all over again. I think it's inevitable. On the other hand, I can look back and there are a lot of different experiences. My first experiences, I was just blown away and kind of dizzy because it was just so different. And I knew there was something really important going on and I had no idea what it was, but I thought I should do it more. And so for a long time, I just kept doing it more, trying to understand how it was and how it fit into my life. And then it became a kind of job at Shikoji. I just felt like I was holding everything together in a situation that was kind of chaotic and strange. And so it did become more of a task, as he says, than it was, had much meaning in my life, because I was so busy and I'd be, you know, maybe the most telling moment was in the middle of a sesshin when I was just barely learning how to lead a sesshin and someone came and whispered to me that the septic tank was overflowing. And so it was that kind of situation continually, that I would be doing the insurance on one side and then I'd be sitting and then I'd be teaching and then I would be taking care of the septic tank and blah, blah, blah. It was just a very crazy time. But I'm very glad that I had that practice. I think I would have gone crazy if I didn't have it. It just kept me in some kind of balance so that I could do it. I could actually do it. And then I got sick and it became a whole different thing again. Same, but different, just because my life condition was different. And I was looking at dying and thinking about that a lot and realizing how nice Zazen was in terms of that. Judy knows about that too. Yeah. So if you go through that experience, then you realize that you not only experience another side in sitting, but there is another side and you're heading there. And so you better get to know it really, really well. And so it was an inspiration, a tremendous inspiration. I've always been so grateful. I had cancer tooth twice in a row. And it wasn't fun, but man, talk about maturity. It was real good. So it was like that. And now I lead a very quiet life, and it's the sweetest thing in my life. It just keeps me there, here, and there's it's not easy. It's a lot harder than it ever used to be physically. It hurts a lot. But everything hurts a lot anyway, so why not sit? Yeah, thank you.
Leonardo and how he envisioned what it is to have a human body. Sometimes I like to look at Buddha statues, you know, or different ones from different branches, you know.
Yes.
Maybe Burmese ones or Thai ones or Chinese ones. But I wanted something. For a day, I wanted something for the same time as this kind of Skype. It's got a kind of a chat thing. So I was looking for all these pictures. You know, I found this wonderful, you know, Grecian era carving.
Yes, from Gandharva. From Gandharva.
Yeah, something like that. And then we have one in my office. I found out it was a room from. And you know, I think about, well, what does this Buddha mean? This was, as far as we know, a person. And somehow.
Well, those images aren't anything like the Buddha.
Artists who did these things managed to express the essence, you know, this, whatever it is. Person, metaphysical, abstract, compassionate, being, you know, just being with reality, just being there and just seeing it.
You know what I think?
Also having this incredible compassion for other beings to understand.
I think that's a real interesting observation. And I think any one of us, if we were sitting for a long time, would be a model for a Buddha statue.
Yeah,
because it's the peace that comes from it. You don't see it yourself.
Yeah.
You know, I see it a lot because I'm cheating and looking at everybody. I can see what happens.
They're all different if you go.
They're all different, but they're all.
On the internet, you can find zillions of them, you know, from temples everywhere.
But I'm talking about the live human being.
Of course. But I'm saying that just.
Because of the variety.
Aspect, that's the real aspect,
yes.
Doesn't it?
Yes.
When it comes down to it, it's not a statue somewhere in a temple.
Yes, but we need something to project on, so, and then people get upset about that. You know, there was a Jewish friend who came to and refused to be around when everybody was bowing. She'd just leave the room when the Heart Sutra was being chanted. Well, yeah, it can easily be, but it isn't.
But anyway, I don't know, somehow your thoughts about Leonardo got me.
Well, check the book.
I've seen reviews of it, yeah, it's a big, who's the author?
Isaacson.
Oh, Walter Isaacson.
Yeah, he's the guy who's written so many famous.
He writes very well, very, very simply. It's almost like reading a child's book.
Yeah.
It's so plain and simple.
That's
It's excellent. It's really very good.
I read Augustine, and that was yay thick, but
yes, well,
I got a third of the way through it, mostly just early life. But that was very enlightening.
It takes a long time.
Very enlightening. Okay, yeah. I'll get the book. Thank you. Sorry to ramble on, but
thank you.
You kind of got my.
Yes, I understand. Well, it's 8:00, so. Announcements?
have an announcement for next week. I'm going to visit my mother in Sparks for her birthday.
Faithful son.
And so you will need someone to open up.
Oh, we will, yes.
Yeah, that's my announcement.
You're our faithful opener, so.
I try to be.
Yes, thank you, Jeffrey. Somebody willing to open?
On Tuesday.
Oh, yeah. Give me a cake.
Yeah, so.
Okay.
We also need an opener, someone to help open this Saturday, the 20th, for our full day sit.
Well, that's right.
On Saturday.
Oh, great. Great. Okay. Yes, 9 to 4. An hour break for lunch. Talk at 1. So come one and all. Can we have our 1 minute sit? Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.